Greetings and salutations, friends and followers of the Lively Arts. This is Jay Michaels here in the Passion Pit, bringing you one-on-ones with some of the movers, shakers, and arts makers in the indie scene today. Now, we're going to now read into the deep words spoken by our two guests. Get it? Read? Words? They're both writers. This first gent I know for over 20 years. I met him as one of the more informed and judicious reviewers at the Off-Off-Broadway Review back in the, and I don't want to say it out loud, the 90s. And now I have the pleasure of following his light-speed trajectory as a playwright. I'm not shy in saying that he is simply one of the best playwrights I have ever known. My colleague and my friend, Doug DeVita.
Hello.
Doug DeVita.
Yes. Jay Michaels.
This is Jay Michaels. If I'm on the phone, you're on the air.
I'm on the air?
Yes.
Oh, my.
I know it's a position you don't, you unaccustomed as you are to public speaking.
You mean? No, I'm very shy.
So I've heard, yes. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. How about you?
Not bad. Not bad at all. I hear there's so many things going on with you these days. I know.
Really? What have you heard?
Well, when we've spoken, I know there was a screenplay being bandied about. I know that we're resurrecting a couple of amazing plays of yours. Tell me what's going on in your life.
Oh, we're trying to. I'm working on a screenplay for The Fierce Urgency of Now. There's been some talk about that. I've never written a screenplay before, so this is kind of fun in a way. I guess the other thing, I started a new show back in June, and I'm on it's the fourth draft now. So I'm getting that ready to do some kind of readings, but I have been submitting it as I've been developing it to places that are specifically looking for developmental works, nothing that's finished,
uh-huh.
Things that they're looking for that they can work with you. And I just found out that this one place, it's made the semifinalist round.
That's so terrific.
That's exciting.
Is this the one with the Sabella brothers?
No. That's something completely different.
See, there's so much going on with you.
Yeah, because I just, it's like I've got time now. I'm an old retired fart. So what do? I write.
So what's
the play for David Sabella is still in its in rough draft form. That's a very interesting piece. It's a little hard for me to write because it doesn't really cover my usual, dark comedies about mothers, martinis, and death. This is about a specific entertainer from the past. His story's fabulous. Julian Eltinge, who was a huge star in the early 1900s into the 30s, and he was a female impersonator.
Mm-hmm.
And he was extraordinarily successful. Strangely enough, there is no audio recordings of him anyway. There's silent film footage, but there's no sound recordings that can be found. Anyway, his career was brought to a halt overnight in the late 30s when LaGuardia enacted the morality laws and shut down the burlesque houses.
Uh-huh.
And his career just went kaput from that because it was considered immoral for a man to dress as a woman. So he basically, his career was shot. It's a fascinating story. David brought it to me. So again, it's not the first time I'm writing specifically for a personality. I did that with Lane Bradbury's show, Let Me Entertain You Again.
Right.
But I went to her with that idea. This David came to me with the idea to write it. So it's a fascinating experience for me. And as I'm writing it, you know, where I'm just leaving spaces for where songs will go, and then I will work with his musical director about what the songs are and where they'll go. And yeah, we have talked about the possibility of David's brother Ernie playing LaGuardia. That's all up in the air. We don't know whether that will happen or not, but it would be fabulous if he could.
That'd be amazing. Both Sabella brothers in that show. For those who don't know, Lane Bradbury was Dainty June in the original Gypsy, and you created a very popular cabaret performance, one woman show, if you will, that she did for many years. Actually, that ran 2 or 3 years, if I remember correctly.
Well, it here and there, I think we did the first. The first incarnation of it was done in, I think, 2014, and then we did it at 54 Below in 2015.
Right.
And then last year it was done several times at Don't Tell Mama. Lane has a lot of irons in the fire. She's working on a show for herself right now, and but there has been some talk recently about her bringing the show. The show's called Let Me Entertain You Again.
Right.
And her bringing the show to Atlanta, which is where she's from, and also do it in L.A., which would be great, and possibly San Francisco. So it would be wonderful. It's a fun show. She has a wonderful story. I mean, you know, there's nothing in her birth or breeding that should have brought her to Broadway in the Golden Age. She's a debutante from Atlanta. But she ended up in, you know, some pretty legendary Broadway shows. I mean, she made her debut in JB. She did Gypsy. She was in The Night of the Iguana with Bette Davis.
Right.
She was even directed by June Havoc in Marathon 33. So she's got some pretty interesting stuff to talk about. But anyway, enough about her. This is about me.
That's right. And it's funny. I'm segueing into something you're saying about her being legendary and the Sabella brothers and all of that. Well, let's talk about someone else who's legendary. Let's talk about you, who's legendary. In the indie world, people last a certain amount of time and then they disappear in some way. You're a warrior. I remember you from 25 years ago. So you have seen the theater scene grow and shrink and change over and over again. As you look back, what's been out there? What have you seen in terms of changes that have been out there?
Well, I think as far as changes go, I think there's a lot more people taking the bull by the horns and not sitting around and waiting for someone else to do something for them. They'll do it themselves.
Right.
I mean, there's always been that element, but lately it just seems to have really exploded. I think the internet obviously has changed all of that. It's also changed the way, unfortunately, I think it's also changed attention spans. And people don't really like to sit for, you know, two and a half hours for a play. It's like everything is like 90 minutes and get me out of here. If you can do it in 10, even better. Let's not talk about 10 minute plays. I think they're horrible.
Thank you.
I think, you know, it's just playing into this shortening attention span. And, you know, it's like, look, you know, give me something to really sit down and chew on. The other thing that I've seen, I will say, it's like, I don't know if I would talk about myself as being a warrior because I have been in and out. It's not been a 25-year constant thing. I've been in and out of the industry, you know, as I've needed to make money. But the thing that I'm finding is that there are a lot of people that whose paths I've crossed over the last 25 years who are all – we're all still in it. And we're all – you know, we're all emerging now. As I made a comment – I'm not going to talk about other people this way. I will talk about myself this way. I made a comment in a workshop a few months ago that when asked to describe ourselves, I said, I'm a rapidly aging, slowly emerging playwright.
Brilliant.
And I find, you know, it's not just me. There's a whole bunch of us who are, you know, roughly within a 10-year age span of each other. And we're all starting to be known, starting to be heard, starting to be, you know, like, oh, yeah. One night last year, I was at the theater, and at intermission, this woman comes up to me and she said, "Are you Doug DeVita?" And I was like, "Yes." I'm thinking, am I being sued for something?
Are you being served at that moment?
Yeah, really, seriously. And she had seen the Philly Trilogy, not only at the Fresh Fruit Festival, but also at the Great Griffin's reading series, a few months before. And she loved it. And she recognized me from the readings and also from being in the audience at Fresh Fruit. And it was a trip, man. I mean, it's like, I couldn't believe it. It was really just like, and I'm nobody. But there I am. I'm in the theater. It's intermission. I forget what show it was. And, of course, everybody around me is hearing her gush about the play and gush about me. And then they're all like, you can hear the buzz. Like, who the fuck is this guy? Excuse me, I shouldn't have said that. Who the hell is this guy?
That's all right. We have parental discretion on the show.
Oh, okay. Well, then, you know, it's like but it's not just me. I can name a whole bunch of people that were all in the same thing. And but we've all been around since, you know, the 90s or before.
Now, you are certainly not a nobody. I'm not going to talk about the F-bomb. Lord knows I should not. But I would never say that you're a nobody. When I met you, you were part of the Off-Off-Broadway Review circuit, and you were one of the people that went to see. That's why I ask you what's new in the world, because you've seen, going back to last century, please pardon me, you have seen the way independent theater has grown and shrunk. You've seen the plays. So you are definitely not a nobody. Has it influenced you as an author? Because you were a critic for many years. Does it, and you still are for Cabaret Hotspot. Has it influenced your writing in sort of seeing all the other plays being written out there, good and bad?
Well, how could it not? First of all, how it's influenced me, I don't know. I haven't really thought that much about it, but I do know that, as you know, and as anyone who has read my Off-Off-Broadway reviews knows, I am a man of very, very definite opinions. And, you know, for the things that I didn't like, I do try to avoid falling into those traps.
Right.
The thing that I have found that has changed, I think there's more than there used to be.
Yeah, I'd agree on that.
I also think that I was going to say what has not changed is the passion for it. Uh-huh. Good, bad, or indifferent, everything I've ever seen has been just backed by a wonderful passion. And that's, you know, speaking of the reviewing, which is why I prefer not to review theater anymore, mm-hmm. is because I don't like to step on the passion behind something. With reviewing for Cabaret, it's a different world, a completely different world. I don't have as much invested in that world as I do in theater. I've written one cabaret show, which is the show for Lane, and that, you know, it plays in cabarets, but that could play in an off-Broadway house. It is a one-woman show.
Yep.
So, you know, when I'm reviewing theater, I you know, like I said, I have very strong opinions, and I kind of don't like who I turn into when I review theater. So I've sort of stepped back from that. I stepped back from it big time about 15 years ago, and then here and there I would do something, you know, if I were requested to.
Right.
But I don't like who I turn into. As I said, writing for Cabaret is easier for me because, as I said, I don't have much invested in it emotionally in terms of what I do. The performers I see are all fabulous. There's very little to carp on, because their shows are always, if not well written, well performed.
Right.
Yeah, you might have a performer who is like, all right, really, do you have to sing Sending the Clowns again? or it's like, okay, you know, you've got this fabulous voice, but why are you singing that song, which was so not written for your voice? You know, it's little quirky things like that, but overall, it's really terrific. And also, you learn a lot from it because you know, the craft is there. The craft of putting a show together. I'm going out on a limb with this one, but in my not so humble opinion, the craft of putting a show together, whether it's a cabaret show or a musical or a straight play or whatever, the craft is the same. You have to engage your audience and take them on a journey. That sounds so fucking pretentious, but
no, it's absolutely right.
You go down that pretentious rabbit hole when you talk to a playwright.
Oh, please, that's exactly right. I recall you in the good old days. You were never destructive. You were always constructive. And
I know a few people who would really disagree with that.
Well, and where are they now? You know, but
Utah, maybe, I don't know.
Yeah,
but up in front of my building with machine guns. I mean, I'm not kidding. I wrote one review that was, it was a really bad production, and I called it on the carpet for everything, and I was stalked. I had to call the cops and get a restraining order on an actor who was turning up everywhere I was. And this was before I was posting like a maniac on Facebook. I mean, social media didn't exist at the time.
Right.
So, you know, I don't know how he found out where I was, but he would show up at places and I'd be like, you know, and I mean, I knew who he was because I'd reviewed the show. And the thing is, I hadn't even mentioned this actor. Maybe that's why he was pissed off.
But, well, there you go.
But I had to get a restraining order against him because it was getting frightening. I'd be at dinner. I'd be at another show. I'd be at the movies. I'd be coming out of work. I was working at NW Air Advertising at the time, and I'd come out into the plaza at Worldwide Plaza, and he'd be sitting there. It was really frightening.
See, I told you how famous you are.
Infamous.
An interesting thing, and I was segueing because you mentioned about not stepping on passion, and I have only seen the open heart in your reviews, even if the show deserved to have its heart cut out. What's your story now? You are an established playwright. Now you're breaching into the world of screenplays. You have seen. You have seen the world of indie theater. What's the story? And you say about how you're rapidly aging, slowly emerging, which is brilliant. What's the story of Doug DeVita? If someone's going into the New Drama Bookstore, I don't know where they're going now, but if someone goes into the New Drama Bookstore and goes to the Doug DeVita shelf, what's the story? What are we saying about you?
Oh gosh, I don't know how to answer that question.
You made the remark about Mother's Martini and death. So, and ironically, even if you're talking about your new piece, there's a female impersonator. Okay, so that's one thing. I'm sure he drank. So, okay, we're almost covered there.
Almost covered, yeah. And he did. He did. In my script, he does not die, but he did die shortly after or after that whole thing happened.
What's the production scheme? What's the heart of Doug DeVita's plays? When we read the canon of Doug DeVita, we walk away thinking what?
This guy's fucked. I have a very, very weird sense of humor. Some people get it, some people don't. I find humor in the darkest subjects. That noise in the background, by the way, that's my dog. He's curled up next to me, sound asleep, and he's snoring. So that's, if you hear some weird sound, that's Max.
I didn't hear that, but Max is as famous as you are these days, thanks to Facebook. So,
and Instagram. Yeah, I know that.
Of course.
He's my calling card. No, but I have a very, very weird sense of humor. I find funny things in things that are just not funny. And I try to put them in my script. I mean, you know, the show's been done, so it's not tipping a laugh anywhere. But, you know, there's that bit in the Silly Trilogy when they're kids and Barbie, the 14-year-old girl, is she's complaining that, you know, she should have been valedictorian, and the girl who got valedictorian got it because she's ill. And she says to Philly, you know, I should have been valedictorian. And Philly says, you don't have cancer. And and it brought the house down every night. It's not a funny situation, but it is in a way because, you know, if Barbie had cancer, she probably would have gotten valedictorian. It's that sort of thing that I find. The other one that I'm in the fourth draft is called Upper Division. And I will make a disclaimer here that, you know, like they say on Law and Order, that the events and the people are purely fictitious. Any event in a similarity to people living and dead coincidental. Yeah, we'll just say that now. But I mean, that script is the culmination of 21 years in academia as a teacher. And there's some really dark things going on in that script, including, you know, mother figures. And there's not as much drinking in this one as my other ones, but there's death. And I had a private reading a few weeks ago in my living room. And it just, I mean, people were laughing so hard they were crying.
Mm-hmm.
In amongst the death and the destruction and all the other stuff going on in that script. So that's what I hope people find in my work.
You find the humor in things we were told not to laugh at. From what I've seen, and you're sort of saying this, we're told not to laugh at certain things. Oh, that person has cancer. Let's not laugh at it. Oh, this is you're not supposed to laugh at it. You're not supposed to, but you show us the great irony. You show us the truth when people say, oh, it's funny because it's true. You show us great truth out there. Everything I've seen of yours, you show us great truth.
Well, thanks. I hope I do. I
mean, oh, yeah.
That's the goal. That's why everything goes into, you know, revision mode 87,000 times. I mean, I'm revising Philly Trilogy. It's, you know, it's won awards and I'm still revising it.
Well, that's the irony of truth. Eventually truth changes.
I guess the other thing I'll talk about, as long as we're talking about the truth and stuff, I think for the work that I'm restarting another one, which is this whole mothers and death and search for truth thing. I'm writing a comedy called Fable, which is about the creation of the musical Gypsy.
Uh-huh.
But from June Havoc's perspective.
That's very
ambivalent relationship to that show. And I find it fascinating. And the show is not about the mother. I mean, the mother, of course, is the most fabulous mother of all time. She's like catnip. But that's been done. Let's face it. You can't top Gypsy. But June's perspective is fascinating to me because she was always about truth. Truth on stage, truth in life, truth in blah, 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 blah. And she lied like the rest of them.
Of course.
She lied as much as her mother did and as much as her sister did. And that relationship is fascinating to me.
So you're sort of showing us that we all know that maybe that's the reason there's such great laughter in your plays. We all know the truth and you're just brave enough to finally put it out there.
Maybe. Who knows? Look, some people like my work. Some people don't like my work. You know, I wish more people who had lots of money and could produce my work would like it. But then again, what playwright? That's like the playwright's prayer.
Of course. Well, you're slowly emerging. It's going to happen.
I hope so. I hope so. I hope it does before, you know, Trump gets us all nuked.
Well, if we could just hold on till 2021 when there's someone else in the White House, maybe we'll be all right.
Please. I'm very interested in what's going to happen in the next couple of months. I think it's going to be, if we're not blown up by New Year's Eve, the next few months are going to be very fascinating. But I will leave that to others to write. That's not of any interest to me.
You're not the science fiction writer. There you go.
Yeah, I'm not. But
Doug, thank you so much. Thank you so much. This has been enlightening. This has been wonderful. I'm glad I had a chance to get you on the podcast. You're a celebrity to me, and that's how it's going to stay. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Jay. You're a celebrity to me as well.
You are most kind. I will.
Kind.
I will tell our fans about your website and where they can find out more about your works and Max and everything else that's within your life.
Sounds great.
Thank you so much, and I will definitely be chatting with you soon.
Sounds good. Thanks, Jay. Ciao. Happy New Year.
Thank you. Same to you. Ciao.
Bye.
Always a pleasure to chat with my buddy Doug. Speaking of writers, Patrick Hickey Jr., write anything lately?
Do you like video games? Do you like to read?
All right, guys, I know that those two things usually don't go so well together, but my new book, The Minds Behind the Games, Interviews with Cult and Classic Video Game Developers, is kind of like an ESPN 30 for 30 collection of interviews with some of the coolest creators in video game history. We're talking iconic games, Deus Ex, Mortal Kombat, Wasteland, NBA Jam, not so iconic, E.T., Night Trap, indie games, Pro Wrestling X, Towerfall. If you love video games, you will love my book. If you know nothing about video games and want to get in the know, read my book. It's available wherever fine books are sold: Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Target, Walmart, and of course my site, patrickhickeyjr.com. It's an awesome book. I had a ton of fun writing it. And simply put, if you want to get in the know and you want to find out stuff that's not even on Wikipedia, check it out. You won't regret it.
Thank you, Patrick. Another author whose acquaintance came to me through the reviewer's pen is Christopher Strzok. He's a respected reviewer at such sites as Cabaret Scenes, and he has a new novel ready to capture our interest. Christopher Strzok, take us home.
Hey, Jay.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing pretty good.
If I'm on the line, then you're on the air.
Oh, sweet.
So, how's everything going with you? I haven't spoken to you in a long time. How's everything going?
Things are going pretty good. Just signed a contract for a second book. Got a contract for a third book coming out soon. And it's things are progressing pretty quickly on that front, at least.
So apprise our listeners. You say you have a second book coming and a third book. Tell us about the first one. Has it come out yet, or is it impending?
June 11th, 2019. So it's coming out pretty soon.
Very cool.
All three books are written. They're all different. The one that's coming out this summer is the one that I told you about before. It's Kennedy and Gold. It's about a singer in 1948 who meets a girl and has to decide between love and his career. And I won't spoil the rest for you, so I have to make the decision. That's been pretty good so far. I mean, I know you wanted to talk a little bit about my career as a critic and how that's kind of gone, and that's really progressed out of writing that book. So,
frankly, that was going to be my latter part. I wanted to hear about you as an author.
Yeah, well, that's what I want to talk about. That's why I'm leading with it. So, as an author, it's been a pretty good experience in terms of, like, you know, just if you write books, you know, people will listen, people will read them, and people get excited about it, and that's a really rewarding experience. And I've been able to continue to use the experience that I've had with current readers to fuel the fire to write more, basically. And now that I've got a publisher who's excited about my work, they've been really supportive of developing kind of my skill set and putting out more of the things that I can write.
That's terrific. That's terrific. Now you say the other two are written. That's great. Well, you seem like the epitome of efficiency in terms of a person. So I can imagine your entire library is already written. What's the next two about? Give us a teaser, if you will.
Yeah. So, the one that I wrote before between the two of them first is going to actually come out second, I think, just because the most recent book that I wrote is a little bit more exciting sounding. Mm-hmm. But I'll start with the first one I wrote. It's a pseudo memoir. I like to call it an unmemoir because it's a kind of a play on the memoir genre. You know, there are a lot of memoirs out there, a lot of people writing about themselves.
Of course.
They always put themselves in the best light. They always have themselves as the protagonist. In my story, I'm the protagonist, but I kind of work as an anti-protagonist, and then I'm the antagonist of another character's story. In the fallout of the experience, it's kind of like, you know, self-reflective, and it's like, you know, were the decisions I made the right ones? Thankfully there's, no bloodshed. There's nothing really serious happening. It's just a study abroad with a bunch of different people from different cultures, and I'm experiencing those different cultures as well as the local culture of Thailand, and kind of sharing what it's like to be a young person in today's social media age without worrying so much about social media. And I think that story is really exciting for me. It's like, it's a little bit of a look back in the past that allowed me to kind of like, rest some demons of like nostalgia as well as a kind of reflecting a more positive light on kind of what the study abroad experience can be. Because it's, like coming back to the United States, you think it'd be helpful for getting a job and things like that, and it doesn't really turn out that way. So, it was just an experience, and it's like any experience. It has its good sides and bad sides, and I think reflecting on it by writing a book allowed me to kind of develop as a person even more so than when I actually did the study abroad.
Now, when you say you created this character, which is you, but that's the anti-hero, was that cathartic in some way by letting go of having to be the white knight? Did it help you in terms of writing the characters?
So it's not really an anti-hero too. That's why it's a play on me. That's why I said anti-protagonist, because like I'm not a bad person in the story. I don't have faults, not huge faults. I'm not like a raging drunk. I'm not Theseus. I'm not like, I'm not sleeping with everybody's wives on the way to Athens and saving everybody as well. But I'm not doing anything particularly heroic. But it was really cathartic in looking at it as the more real picture, and that the fact that I was playing with other people's emotions and just by being, aggressive or assertive in certain ways. And the more cathartic part was like looking at it as like, if you do something, drinking late at night or going out at 3 a.m., you look like you're going out at 3 a.m. and you're drinking every night, and if somebody has more, higher standards on their, boyfriend, basically, or boyfriend material than somebody who goes and parties every night, then you're not really fulfilling the criteria. And when you mess with people's emotions and kind of like have something happen, you can look back and be like, if I would have cleaned up my act, maybe I would have been in a better position anyway. But I wanted to party and I wanted to have fun. So it's two sides of the same coin. Like it was fun. But it is kind of like negligent behavior in some ways. That was the kind of reflective part of it.
So realistic and cautionary at the same time, that's a novel approach, pardon the pun.
Yeah. Well, that's what I'm going for. Trying to fulfill the genre of novel. I think the expectation is that a novel, at least in some cultures, that the word novel means, you have a new experience when you approach a text or a book or a book of art. And I think that I've worked really hard to do that. Moving into the next novel, I took a little bit more of a fundamental literary approach where I wasn't looking at playing with how a character works, because with The Sun Never Set, I played with how characters work together, but I didn't necessarily do anything that was really new in terms of the text. With 8, which is my eighth book, which is why I called the book 8, but it stuck because it works really well with this narrative of the story.
Mm-hmm.
It also has a really long subtitle, A Song for the Peach Tree in My Master's Garden, but 8's a lot more memorable. I wrote a story about a samurai in Japan at the turn of its kind of like major historical moment. So back in Japan, it used to be an empire for hundreds of years, had a lot of different warring factions going back and forth. And at one point in the history of Japan, there was this massive war between the daimyo and supporters of future daimyo and the emperor of Japan and the true right or true heir of what had been a budding superpower.
Mm-hmm.
And caught in the midst of that was one of the most famous samurais of Japanese history, Miyamoto Musashi, who maybe not is maybe not known as the best samurai in Japanese history, but in some cases he is. He was undoubtedly the most like well-known for his dueling ability, and he never lost a duel in over 60 duels, and the only person who came close fought in 30 or so, so in terms of record of undefeated duels. And so I wrote basically about the build-up to his life and the build-up to this significant moment when the daimyo seizes power, and then his kind of run of dueling after the daimyo seizes power. And so it's not necessarily the most romantic picture of the story, but I set it up to be structured like a Japanese story structure. So it kind of develops that way. And then as a like older samurai, he kind of takes out revenge on the people that had betrayed the emperor in his early life.
Are you a history lover? Is this a passion of yours? Because I'm noticing the historic element within your books. Are you a great lover of history, or you just found picturesque locations?
Yeah, I would say that there are certain aspects of history that I really love. Like, I'm actually reading now A Brief History of the Vikings, and I think that that definitely history has always been, I think, a major player. But I think that it's just fascinating how cultures develop and kind of where we are now, and how we're in a very peaceful time of human history in a lot of respects. And I think that, you know, if you look back and you see like the, you know, the history of Normandy or the history of Denmark, it's not as clear cut as like, you know, nobody was holding hands and singing Kumbaya. They were you know, some guy was, you know, he was really strong and he decided he wanted to go kill people, and he killed people. And then he was like, well, it's not enough to just kill people. I need some wives. So he got some wives, and then he had a lot of children, and he was like, well, this is my kingdom. And then everybody else had to just deal with that. And I think that that's, it's interesting to read because it's not something that we really have to deal with anymore today. We're just looking at, the world from like a perspective of it's already here, you know, like you don't need the founding of Denmark anymore because Denmark's there.
Right.
And I think that that's what's interesting about it. And I think that you can kind of paint like a more realistic perspective on the past if you look at it from kind of the perspective that violence exists and it's not necessarily supposed to be cherished or anything, but it happens and it's on both sides. And I think it's just part of like, it's an interesting part of reading on history.
It's funny you say that. I was at a stage reading at the beginning of the week about a play about Abraham Lincoln and Frederick Douglass, and it showed the real Lincoln, and he wasn't as nice a guy as everyone, you know, purports him to be now. And you could see the audience's faces as suddenly they got a genuine history lesson at certain quotes that Lincoln had said that no one ever imagined he would say. So it's interesting that you say we look at a place and say, okay, there it is. But what did it take to get there? What did that nation, what did that country look like 100, 1,000 years ago? You piqued my interest when you said the Vikings, because that's the foundation of almost every civilization when you get right down to it, is the Vikings. So that's...
Yeah, I mean, it actually is. It's pretty crazy how much of the modern world they touched on. I mean, they traded with the Arab world. They traded with the Greeks. They traded with... they basically conquered England. You know, it's pretty interesting. Anyway,
yeah. And it goes to what you're saying about that template. Okay, some Vikings said, okay, I'm now going to pillage, then I'm going to get women, then I'm going to have kids. And that was really their modus operandi in so many ways. And they ended up literally creating the world in simply trying to get gold.
Yeah. And so it's kind of interesting how much England gets beat up in this like history of, that I'm reading. But you know, and then England got back on their feet at some point and basically copied the same pathway to their own like historic greatness. And that's actually, you know, if you're looking at England, their classic tagline, "The Sun Never Sets on the Empire," that's actually how I got the title for my book, "The Sun Never Set."
Except, oh, that's so cool.
You know, minus the S, and it's not about an empire, like realistically, it's about the empire in our imaginations, and like, the sun never set on the like imaginary empire we envisioned we could create as like young people.
Your books sound fascinating. I bet the narrative of them creates these amazing pictures in our heads because I'm seeing all of them talking to you right now. I can only imagine once I dig into the books. Do you consider yourself is your main, you know, they talk about John Travolta and he's an actor, but he considers himself a pilot. What a lovely commercial. But are you an author? If someone said Christopher Strzok, comma, author, that's your decision in life, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, I think that with all those things, you want to be, you kind of want to have other people describe you as something, and you want to kind of capture people's imagination in some ways. I don't necessarily know, because I do also work as a critic, and I don't necessarily want being a critic to be the only thing that like comes up, just right. Like you said, like whether it's author. I think that for me, I just don't want to have like so many things at the end of. Like after my name, I want to kind of just be known for the work that I put out there. And then also, to be able to kind of move on from a work and create something new that's, drastically different that allows people to basically be like, oh shit, this guy really understands his art more than just making it into kind of a craft piece. You know, I'm not like making the same, banana sculpture every time I make a sculpture. I'm making like, you know, I can make a banana and then I can also make like a stone totem to whatever, but. You know, I think
but it's what's in your heart. It's your art, if you will, and that's that.
Yeah, exactly. And I think I think author is kind of a too simple of a word. I think novelist is probably more accurate. I don't think, but I think at the same time, like we're approaching kind of a new world where you know you can Google somebody and it, like six or seven things come up after their name, and I think that you know inevitably. There will be six or seven things that come afterwards, and I hope that novelist is the first one. I think that people will be like, "No, he does a really good job at that." So, that's the thing he's most well known for.
With three books heading for our shores already, yes, I think that's a good guess that they're going to call you the novelist, and I think that's wonderful. Now, you have alluded obviously to your career as a critic. It's really interesting because you are, you're a musical critic for cabarets. Is that the main focus? Is that the main thing that you look at in terms of your reviewing?
It's become that way. I mean, when I first started out, I was doing, more plays than musicals. But I got the opportunity to review for cabaret scenes and it stuck more than the, reviewing plays did. I just, kept doing it and I got to review like, bigger and at more fancy venues, and I can still review pretty much around New York as long as there's like a musical note to the piece. And I think I've seen some really fantastic performers, some performers who take it really seriously that you never hear about, and then some performers who don't take it seriously that people have heard about. And so I've seen sold out rooms for performers that have absolutely no like. Major brand, and I've seen sold out rooms for performers that have major brands that also like their own name is their brand, and yet they perform and you're like, well, why does this person have anybody here, because this is horrible.
Why is that? As a reviewer, as someone who has seen a major cross section of a prevailing genre, why is that? Why let's talk about it in cabaret, but it can be associated with all forms of art on this. Why, when you go see a cabaret show, what strikes you when you look at something and say, okay, I don't understand or I understand? What's your criteria when you look at a piece? What does it have to do to touch you?
Now, I think that people just have to be like really emotionally invested in the work. And I think that, I think it's too simple to just stand still and sing a song and then like be like, oh, and I'm so great because when I was younger, blah, blah, blah. And I think that, when people do that, I think it gets a little mundane and it's kind of boring. And I think, if you take, everybody does inevitably almost the same thing, but I think if somebody takes that same thing and then makes it a little bit interesting and then also like puts more of their own like emotion behind it, I think it gets a little bit exciting. I think, one really classic example was Reverend Mary with her Lady in Black and like talking about her own like sort of love history. I think that was really fun. I think it was a really unique way of looking back on the past. Not everybody does that. Most people just stand up on stage and like say when I was in high school, I did this. When I was in college, I did this. When I was in whatever, I did this. And then that's how they introduce the song. And I think that's a really simple way of looking at it. But I don't think the audience is like sitting there going, oh my God, this is a gripping performer, next level genius. I think they're more like, I guess this is what I paid for. You know, I $45 and, you know, I get to see some random tell me how random his life has been. But yeah, I think, you know, one of the most interesting things about that in like any way is like, or from any perspective, I guess I should say, is that there was this one classic line from a song I used to listen to a lot called, where they went, would you rather be a drop in the ocean or a star in the sky? Both of them are pretty much like, you know, there are a million stars in the sky, or a billion, you sound more accurate, but, and there are a million, billion drops of water in the ocean. And I think, you know, people are pretty content to just fall among the stars and be one of them. And I think that that's kind of what you see play out on stage is like, you know, some person has gained some like renown or fame to a certain level and they're content with that. And they're not looking to get, you know, better or be really good on stage. They're looking just to be, you know, just to perform kind of what to expectations of the venue. And like, you know, some people get on stage at the same venue and will just be lights out. Like I saw this guy, Kurt Elling, earlier this January, and I was sitting there thinking to myself, like, this guy is probably the best performer I've seen, like hands down, over 200 shows now. And he's incredible. You know, and he also had a sold out audience and he's got a really big following. And, you know, not only does he have a really big following, but he also is like pushing the boundaries of his art still further. And I think that, you know, I even like a couple weeks before I saw somebody perform who had a sold out crowd, had a big following, but it wasn't anywhere near that level of ability. And I think that that gap is pretty large, but you know, to like the casual observer in today's world where it's so hard to kind of see any difference between like who's who or like what's happening, like, or why, or who to go see, or why you would listen to one person in particular. I think.
Why is that? I'm going to jump in and ask, because that's a huge question. That's been asked of me about 10 or 12 times, like this year alone, and we're not even a month in. Why is that? Why? I don't even have the words for it. Why is that what happens these days? How come we don't know the difference? How come there's elaborate on that, because that's really a brilliant comment you made.
Well, I mean, I think you're thinking about it a lot. In particular, I don't think I have like a really well-formulated answer, but I'll kind of give you a little bit of my two cents on it. You know, I think that it's very easy to build something, a platform online that looks relatively professional. And I think it's really hard for people who are trying to take it more seriously to break through the noise. And I think that if you look at somebody like Kurt Elling, for example, I mean, he's been doing this for, I don't know, I think he looks like he's probably in his 50s. He might be a little older than that. I see he's got to be doing this for like 30 years or something. You know, that in of itself is like, you know, just staying power. And I think he's been able to get a reputation. But, you know, it probably wasn't easy along the way. And I don't know all the stories of his own background. But, you know, if you look at Instagram today, you know, he became an artist before Instagram. He's now an artist in the Instagram world. He's got an Instagram. He's got about 10,000 followers. But if you look at Instagram and you're like, you know, how to find a, you know, generational singer in jazz, like it's not that easy. You can't just type in generational singer of jazz and find Kurt Elling. You'll probably find some girl in her house singing some jazz tune with a guitar and you know, she might be really good too. I mean, you honestly, in that setting, you can't really tell. And, you know, one of them might grow up to be a really fantastic jazz singer someday, but one of them is a really fantastic jazz singer right now. And you can't really discern in that perspective. I mean, that's just like, there are other criticisms you can have of social media, but I think it's really easy for everybody, I think, to turn to the internet to find information. I think it's really hard to realize that the information you might be finding on the internet is incomplete. And I think that, you know, in other respects, like it's something that it's something that's hard to gain perspective on, even if you're criticizing the internet for something, or you're realizing or recognizing that, you know, Wikipedia isn't enough information, but it's still good information. So, you know, proponents or people who support Wikipedia are still going to be, aren't going to be swayed by, you know, circumstantial evidence of to the contrary. But if you're looking at an example, one of my books with writing the story about the Japanese samurai, it wasn't like all Wikipedia searched information. Yeah, I did use Wikipedia as well, but a lot of the substance and background for the story came from, you know, watching anime as a kid, watching Hayao Miyazaki, and then studying Hayao Miyazaki and studying anime and kind of what made those things work. And then when I went to Japan, going to the National History Museum and kind of seeing what it was like to be a Japanese person back in the 1600s, and then looking at that and then reading books that were set in the 1600s written by Japanese authors, and then stepping back and kind of combining all those things into one thing. So, for example, you don't really know what it's like to believe in ghosts if you're Japanese, if you're not Japanese, you know. And going to the Japanese History Museum, I was able to see a lot of artifacts about, you know, the history of Japanese ghosts, which you wouldn't necessarily know. And you can't Google search it as an American. It's not that easy. You can't just be like, what is the history of Japanese ghost belief in Japan? It doesn't work. I mean, something will probably come up, but a lot of that information is still written in Japanese, is still in Japan, and you can't necessarily access it that easily. And I think for the casual tourist who goes to Japan, they're not looking to travel to the Japanese History Museum. I think that's a little above brow of like most people who go.
So in a way, what you're saying with performers using your book very well as an example, you didn't just go to Wikipedia, you didn't just watch anime, you found the people that would have known your character. You made that book real. You might be the novelist, but you made it completely real. I guess maybe what you're saying with social media is you just need enough money to make that website, but that doesn't mean you have the talent behind it. It's that extra connection to the audience. It's reading a book in Japanese to know exactly what you should be presenting. It's the feeling that comes into it that makes the big difference, apparently.
Well, I mean, I wish I could read a book in Japanese, but I just read a book written by a Japanese person.
Translated from Japanese. All right. Yeah.
Yeah. But I did study Japanese, for a while, about 3 years, and, that made a pretty big impact. One of the things I did to study Hayao Miyazaki was I did actually do a presentation on him a number of years ago in Japanese class in Japanese, and I did all the research for it to find kind of like substance in Japanese stuff. So that kind of helped out later in life, because I was like, you know, I have all this background in Japan, and at least researching Japanese stuff, like how am I going to put this into use and kind of like put it to rest, because it's not like I'm going to Japan anytime soon. And, you know, I love the culture and I love eating sushi, but, you know, it's a lot more complicated than sushi. There's way more to it. And I think I can't go and study Japanese regularly at this point in my life. So it's like, you know, all of that, you know, knowledge that I gained over the years, I'm going to try to put it to use somehow. And that became the novel.
Your life experience, of course, of which you have immense, for one so young as you. I think
it's
very lucky.
Great. I mean, thanks. Been very lucky, especially with the critic thing. I mean, I basically just said yes to a thing in New York to do, and I've been able to go all over the city to different parts of the city and see some very like dingy places and see some very like, you know, nice places. for example, like, you know, being in Cafe Carlisle is an example of a pretty nice place. You know, they give you a steak dinner, you know, you write a review. I haven't been back since, but, you know, that's okay. The an example of a much dingier place is the old KGB theater in the Lower East Side in East Village. Yeah.
Oh, love that
the
one.
Literary
yes.
world. It's historic.
Yep.
To the theater world, it's also historic. And as a literary point of like historic reference, it's like, oh yeah, great authors came through here and talked about their books. And from a historic theater perspective, it's like, this place has, you know, paint peeling off the walls and the seats are all stained. So, yeah.
But it was there during the Off-Off-Broadway movement, so it was definitely something to be remembered.
I mean, it's definitely something to be cherished. The upholstery could probably be repurposed, but at the same time, like, that's part of life. Like, you know, and now me enjoying it today, it's like, you know, I can see there were enough seats here to seat a few people, and when it was new, it was probably really exciting.
Yep.
At this point, it's like, you know, the Off-Broadway, there are a lot of Off-Broadway plays that run. Some of them are extremely good. Some of them are not as good, and you kind of, you know, pick your poison. You see different stuff, and you get to enjoy. If you want to enjoy Manhattan Theater, that's part of it. You know, you're going to see some newer places, even in the Off-Broadway world. You're going to see some older places, and I think that's always been the case. And if you're okay with sitting in a chair that looks like it might have been used for something nefarious, and like, you know, somebody getting a little too excited in the crowd, then you're gonna make it. You're gonna be able to enjoy theater. If you can't handle the stain on the chair that's, you know, oddly placed, you probably should just stick to 54 below or something.
Right. If it's the experience of, well, it's in a way I can understand your philosophy. It's experiencing history just like your novels. You're you know, sitting in that weird chair is sending you back to another time period. So whatever show you're seeing it in this time capsule, if you will. So it's okay. So it's a bit that maybe the rug needs a good vacuum, but you're in the middle of history.
Yeah. Well, you are. Yeah. Aftermath. Yeah. Historic aftermath.
Exactly. Chris, thank you so much. This has been absolutely wonderful. June is when the book's coming out?
June 11th, 2019. Yeah, it's exciting. Got the cover together that's just posted online. I don't know if they've done an official reveal yet, but they just finished the cover. They told me the focus groups loved a particular one more than any of the other ones, and I was like, you know, let's do it. You know, it doesn't look to me as much like what I kind of imagined the cover would look like in the end, but at the same time, I think it really speaks to the story, and I think it really it's really artistic, and that's what I'm going for. I'm going for something that captures the imagination.
Can you tell us a website or something where we can learn more about the book, or even order it if it's a pre-order?
I don't know if pre-order's like up yet, honestly. But you can come to my website, struckchris.com. I got a little character profile written up of both the main characters. That's probably the easiest way. Otherwise, it's BHC Press, BHC Press, BRESS. That's how everybody can handle that. My name, Christopher Struck. So,
and there you are.
There's maybe not a plethora of information available on the online on the website, but you know what information is available is there, and I would hope that if people are interested by the tidbits that I give out, that they'll dive into the book and see what there is to learn and explore.
Well, they're definitely going to be interested. Number one, you're a fascinating person, and number two, I am going to screen this to the rafters until it comes out, so they'll have no opportunity to forget about your book.
Sweet, thanks, Jay.
Anytime.
Yeah, pleasure talking to you this morning.
Indeed, same here.
Let me know.
I know where to find you.
Yeah, you do. Yeah. All right.
Thank you very much. Same to you. Ciao.
One of our sponsors is Oplaud. This is a service that previews and promotes your show. We'll be speaking to Andrew Andrews. That's right. The founder of this venerable organization next week. And a visit with my oldest friend, now a prominent writer and dealmaker for indie films, Joel Eisenberg. That next time. See you then.